Yeah. Call to order the meeting of the Planning Commission for Tuesday, July 2nd, 2019 at 5:30 p.m. If we could start with introductions across my way.
Tom Nevins, North Kitsap.
And Steve Heacock, Department of Community Development.
Scott Diener with DCD as well.
Jim Swenson, South Kitsap.
Jim, please, yeah, turn your mic on. Thanks.
Mike Elias in Central Kitsap.
Joe Phillips, North Kitsap.
Aaron Murphy, North Kitsap, and I am acting vice chair in Commissioner Allen's absence, so excuse any of my layman's term versions of Robert's Rules of Order, as I've not been here for a bit, but I think we'll get through it with a little help from each other. Item B on our agenda is the adoption of agenda. Does anybody want to make a motion that the agenda is adopted, or do they have recommendation for change?
Move to adopt the agenda as presented.
I'll second that.
Been moved and seconded by Mr. Swenson. All in favor? Show of hands. We do have a quorum, so that's the unanimous approval. Now, with approval of minutes, in discussion before starting recording this evening, it became clear around the table that the five of us here that make a quorum, in fact, at least one of us was absent at each of the minutes meetings that we were looking to approve this evening. And so therefore, if we were to abstain from those, we would not have a quorum to approve. Therefore, I'd ask for a motion that we continue that for an approval at a future meeting date.
Move to delay approval of the minutes.
Do I have a second?
Second.
Mr. Eliason, thank you for your second. So the meeting minutes for April 16th, May 14th, and May 21st will be moved to a future meeting for approval.
But just clarification, I was voting to second to delay it. That could be later in this meeting, too. I don't know if you're expecting other commissioners to.
That's a fair point. So for the moment, should we say that that motion is to delay it, as in not item C for this evening, but if a quorum were available before the end of the meeting, we could revisit that item.
I appreciated the commissioner's clever motion. I don't know if he intended it that way, but I thought it was. So, to delay.
I'll pretend that I was clever, sure. Okay, so yeah, if Ms. Buskirk or Ms. Allen were to show up, we will bring that back into the items for this evening. Item D on our agenda is general comment. Who do we have?
Is there any public comment?
Does anybody have anything they need to share or want to share from the audience? Okay. Item E is work study, timber harvest code update. Mr. Scott Diener from DCD, Development Services and Engineering, is a manager in that department. Mr. Diener, would you like to take over?
Yes, I would. Thank you. And with me tonight is our expert on forest practices, Steve Heacock, who will be doing much of the presentation. But what I'd like to do is just quickly review the last work study, which was May 14th?
Yes.
That sounds right. So yeah. At that meeting, we reviewed what we are intending to accomplish with the proposed transfer of jurisdiction from DNR to DCD for class forest, general forest permit activities. We also reviewed what we're not intending to do, which is to take over those special forest permit activities, which includes aerial application of herbicides and the like, which initially got a lot of people really excited about what they thought DCD was trying to do earlier this year. And so what we did to kind of get the word out was a very robust citizen advisory committee rotation of meetings, public meetings, outreach. Steve also met with the Kingston Environmental Coalition, who perhaps as a group was most concerned about what we were doing. And then after going out for a substantive period of time on public opportunity to comment, we came to the Planning Commission and had that work set. And we reviewed just in general, some of the code issues. The way I pictured it at the time was that this was a three-prong effort. One is to update the code to reflect the transfer of code responsibilities. The second was to take a look at how we are helping the public and ourselves with monitoring of this activity and getting the word out of this activity with the neighbors, and that would be done through using more robustly the inspectors that we have. Thank you. And then also the third prong was to take a look at our processes to see how those could be improved. We, Steve and I, and many in DCD understand that this particular set of permit activities is ripe for review. So we're hoping that with tonight's requested recommendation from the Planning Commission to go to public hearing on this, with that blessing, then that means that I think that we're ready to kick off a formal set of processes and the official transfer of jurisdiction with DNR. And that begins for them, it begins a clock. But at the last meeting, there was the Planning Commission asked that we have another meeting with the major timberland owners. And so we did. We met with them on the 17th of this month, of last month. It was a good meeting. We invited a number of people, and you I think everybody got a copy of the revised memo of the meeting notes. Really, the meeting notes were the key notes that came out of that. I had asked that people who attended that meeting bless those notes, and so I got some input back. And so what you see in that memo, the second memo, has been looked at, and I think it's pretty accurate. So we had three landowners and a in-house counsel with the Washington Forest Protection Association. The three landowners, it was good to have them. They were all of varying sizes of timberland interests, so it was good to have different perspectives from a large, medium, and perhaps smaller landowner. It was very productive. One of the first things we began the conversation with was an understanding that trees, no matter how you, which side of the tree you stand on, it's kind of a passionate issue for people. Some people really don't care for them. Some people love them. Some people have trauma associated with trees that have fallen on their houses. We work with somebody in DCD who was nearly killed by a tree. And so we all have to recognize that people have very strong views about how trees are managed. And so that was a good way to set the stage. There's a lot of passion going into trees. We also talked about code. And we've recognized that there's a couple areas of code that could be tweaked. We haven't really proposed any code language yet, and I don't think we're done, but our goal is to have a revised code to the Planning Commission in time for the next public hearing, and I think it will be generally pretty small, minor tweaks to the code. One of the things we spent some time talking about was appeals. There was a concern by the users of the permits that neighbors, for $500, can be obstructionist with appeals. We talked about how the current fee, which is $500, really was designed to be accessible to people who legitimately wanted to appeal but didn't have deep pockets. And so that number of $500 was settled some time ago. But we also understood that there could be people that wanted to kind of protect land that's not theirs necessarily. And so we're gonna take that offline and look at that as a set of policies. So more to come on that. We also talked about permits and processes. I think the group that we worked with, and I think many of them are here tonight, are really keen to be involved, and I think we'll have them sit with us as stakeholders and walk through some of the processes. And one of the gentlemen tonight actually has done some digging around with an adjacent jurisdiction, Pierce County, and said he really likes what they do, and so that's something that we could certainly land on or look at. There was another discussion about how it would be nice if people who are buying land next to or within proximity of working forests would have to have a there would have to be a real estate disclosure on that. And so
it'd have to be a what?
Real estate disclosure.
Okay.
That your property that you're proposing to buy is within a certain distance of a working forest. And then Martha Whaling with the Washington Forest Protection Association actually provided the House Bill 1011 reference, which actually accomplished that this year. And this act applies prospectively to residential real estate disclosure statements and essentially just adds working forests into the statement that this notice is to inform you that the real property you're considering for purchase may lie in close proximity to a farm or working forest. So that ups the ante a little bit with realtors and making sure that their prospective buyers are aware that they could be next to some property that will have active or working forests. And then the last thing we talked about was looking at adjusting code a little bit so that we could allow for mineral extraction, or what we were calling borrow pits, to maintain some of the working forest infrastructure. So think of roads in or out of these properties or landing areas.
I have a question on that. Now, okay. When we're talking about this.
Tom, can you use your mic, please?
Class 4. Are we talking about small acreages at this point? We're not talking about stuff that needs roads, are we?
Yeah. So the Class 4 general permits include both conversion and conversion options. So the best example I give of the conversion option permits are think of your subdivisions. You go in, and if you got a 40-acre subdivision and you want to fill it with houses, you go in and you clear most of those trees so that you can put in the infrastructure. So that's a good example. And another probably good commercial example to get away from subdivisions is think of Harrison Hospital. They had to come in for a conversion permit to clear a bunch of trees along the northern edge of their lands in order to expand the hospital. So those are a couple of examples of where you would build roads in. And then there's also a conversion option where, and you can probably speak to this better than I, where there's some roads that lead into that. And we've got a little more discussion in the PowerPoint slides that we can talk about.
I'm just curious how you would need a borrow pit or gravel access to gravel on your land for doing that.
And you might not need it, but there are some of the larger landowners actually have some of that.
Oh.
And they would like to be able to use that on their roads maintenance and landing sites and on site. Mm-hmm. So those were the main talking points that we had with that work group on June 17th. My boss, until tomorrow, Jim Boulder, had asked also that we kind of walk the group through what type 1, 2, 3, and 4 permits were in a little more detail just for context. And then he'd also asked that we go through code as well. So if there aren't any questions at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Steve, who's going to kind of walk through what we're talking about, beginning with sort of a broader scope, and then he'll winnow down into class 4.
Just one question. You'd mentioned that of the three landowners that were represented there, there was concern about neighboring property owners paying the $500 and appealing. So far as I've seen, we're not adding any new appeal process, are we? So if let's say Kitsap County, that DC did not take over the process, those processes are still in place with the state of Washington, and the difference is you'd have to go through their administrative function in Enumclaw versus in Kitsap, correct? So why is there concern? Is there an interest in trying to have Kitsap restrict the appeal process? I'm not quite following.
So let me.
I guess what I'm asking of staff is why is it a valid concern?
So we're going to own a new permit type that prior was appealable to DNR.
Right.
Now it's appealable to Kitsap County Hearing Examiner. And so there's a lot of concern about much more accessible appeal opportunity than one might thought they had with DNR.
Okay, that's what I thought it might be.
Yeah, and so with these, you know, all of our type 1, 2, and 3 permits are appealable to the hearing examiner for $500. You can go in, and actually you can kind of extend the appeal process quite a ways out if you want, because the hearing examiner is not necessarily keen to rush attorneys for their work product. And so, for example, we've got one permit where it was a continued appeal. We first met 2.5 months ago,
yeah.
Or most recently met 2.5 months ago, mm-hmm. with the hearing examiner, and now it's been bumped out to September. That's quite a long time,
right,
to have somebody's livelihood, money,
right,
I'll sit in no man's land. So there are alternatives to our current appeal processes that we've talked historically about, and we'll be talking more about those.
Okay. All right, thank you.
And with that, I'm going to turn, unless there are any other questions, I'm going to turn it over to Steve.
You differentiated between the class 4 and the class 4 special.
Yes.
Which was, the class 4 special had to do with forest practices and spraying herbicides, et cetera, et cetera. Given that the county has passed a resolution on not using glyphosate on, except in rare cases, and given that these are conversion permits where you're talking about converting forest land from forest land to some higher use, why is it not appropriate to consider talking about forest practices on that kind of land if you're going to return it into residential or whatever?
Well, let me take a stab at this,
yeah.
And you'll probably end up correcting me anyways. But the Type 4 specials are those that those permits regulate working forests. Those are where people are coming in and clearing for logging or selectively thinning for logging. And that's where they come in and tend to use those herbicides, either aerial or hand spraying.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where you see that particular chemical used. For what we're talking about here, for what DNR is proposing to give to DCD and what we're proposing to accept, you don't see that chemical used, as I understand it.
Yeah,
now, I'm going to turn
right.
it over to Steve and
typically.
Ask him to fill in the
yeah.
gaps.
Wouldn't seem to be in their interest because they're
right.
not growing trees.
Right.
While we have a pause, I'll just remind you to swallow your mic for Robin's sake.
Okay.
Typing purposes. She's constantly straining her ears anytime you don't lean forward. Thank you.
Okay. All right. If there aren't any further questions.
Go on, you'll have to share and just
it's
lean in
them.
Further.
No worries. All right.
Well, here.
Oh, okay. All right. That'll work.
Scott's officially done.
Okay.
All right, Mr. Heacock, if you would.
Very good. Thank you so much. Let's just get this PowerPoint going here. I think we should be able to see this from both sides, so that the audience will be able to see this as well. There we are.
Right.
Okay, here we are now. And, you're picking that up okay, Robin? All right, so obviously we kept the same date from the previous that we were going to present this. What is being proposed? DNR and Kitsap County proposed that DCD assume management of Class 4 general forest practices, and this is what's typically called a transfer of jurisdiction. So we are essentially going to be taking over from the state those types of conversion logging permits. These are also typically called conversion logging permits. And typically, those kinds of permits, the way that we have processed them in the past is that, and that will be altered, obviously, is that we have a application that's gone through all of their land use. They've had their public hearing. They've had, say, a conditional use permit. I'll give the example that Scott provided about Harrison Hospital, where we had the public hearing. The developer's agreement was created. They broke ground, if you will, with a site development activity permit. But prior to that site development activity permit, the applicant was required to get this conversion logging permit from the state. So as it's a Class 4 general permit, our procedure was that we would go with the applicant through a separate permit called a timber harvest conversion logging permit. And so they would apply for that at the same time that they were having their pre-construction meeting with the department. And now what used to be a procedure where they could waive all of the associated processes with the state and get a direct conversion logging permit from the state. Well, that had changed about 3 or 4 years ago. Now they were now required to wait 2 weeks in addition to, so they'd have their logging permit, they knew the harvest level, they knew that the county was going to be guiding it through the site development activity permit. And so the delay of 2 additional weeks for them to start was an issue that we kept hearing about. So part of this process is going to be a process improvement for developers as well. Let's see if this is working. Yes. Okay. So just to get into the different classifications of timber harvest, there's a class one type of application. There's no notification that's required from either the county or the part of DNR as well. These are forest practices that are both seen in both jurisdictions, if you will. And we're going to be talking more so about the class three and class four permits with DCD. There are very rarely class two permits that go through our conversion option harvest plan procedure. Say a timber owner doesn't want that 6-year permit moratorium, they can come to the county. They have to meet all the county rules, and they can do a commercial thinning of their stand and still be a class two forest practice as long as they're outside of the urban growth area. And they're able to do that very easily with our department. But it's pre-approved by the county and then overseen by the state, those particular instances. And I have some examples, specific examples here coming up in just a sec.
Can I ask, do you get many calls during the course of a year by property owners or others that have gone in and clear-cut the property, and then they, even with the class two, the moratorium, either the whoever the professionals were, including the loggers, didn't tell them, and now you get a property owner affected, and they didn't realize they're going to have the moratorium.
It happens about every 2 weeks on average. There's someone that's calling. There's a property that's being marketed for sale, and the particular property has a 6-year permit moratorium because the logger and the applicant or whoever the original landowner was agreed to do a DNR only logging, and that DNR logging can be 100% logging of that property with no consideration of buffers, particular kinds of, in fact, wetlands, can be impacted either directly or indirectly with wetland buffers as long as replanting occurs. State rules are quite a little bit different than county rules in relation to logging. So that does happen. That does happen quite often. We get those calls, yeah. And it's difficult to tell people that, especially someone who's bought a property, already gone through the purchase and sale agreement. We have a battle plan for that. We're going to talk about that a little bit later, about how to provide a little bit different noticing so people are able to look on the county website and see if there's a moratorium. Because the county is notified on all Class 2 and all Class 3 and all Class 4 special permits about the forest activity. We are provided a notice, and that's the county's responsibility, and the only responsibility in relation to that is that we process that six-year permit moratorium once the application is either officially notified or approved.
Is there any way to create something that is tagged in regard to title? Because I think of it like a Form 17 during a purchase and sale of a home, right? You have to disclose what you know.
Yeah. And there is a procedure that can occur. And in fact, the state used to pay for the notice to title to be recorded. But as it's only permit related and not related to any other activity, the department several years back had determined, well, when DNR decided not to record those on the title, that we would record them administratively as a hold tag on the parcel. So if anybody applied for a permit on that parcel, the hold tag would pop up. So that's what we're going to hope to create part of this procedure, is that we're going to create a way that anyone can look on the parcel and see, that was logged. And then we have the date of when that expires. So the six-year date terminates once that.
You're referring to it being maybe something we click on in their GIS parcel system search.
Correct.
Still not a way to tie it to title.
Yeah.
In the theory that it would actually pop up during a purchase and sale.
Yes, right. And if you think of the amount of staff time that it takes to record a notice to title, it's significant. And so, you know, the department's take on it at the point was, you know, we're just going to create this particular notice. And it's end dated too. So we have the notice to title, hold tag placed on the parcel itself, the specific parcel, and then it's end dated as to when that six-year period ends. But so that then we don't have that note that pops up, doesn't pop up anymore.
Okay. Better, I mean, nice that it's public knowledge and searchable.
Yes, exactly.
Still kind of a scary buyer beware situation.
Sure. Yes, and it has happened before too. Yeah, you want to speak to that a little bit too? Yeah, okay.
So I was just going to say that we can certainly talk more about that during our processes part of this whole discussion. But one of the things we are trying to do is improve our parcel search. And if you haven't looked at parcel search in some time, I'd encourage you to go look at it today. Today it tells you, well, it's always told you what your zone is, but today it tells you what the uses are allowed in that zone. It tells you what your setbacks are now. We are endeavoring to, if we've not already done it, show you if you're in a commercial district, whether there are any design standards for that property that you're looking at. And we're constantly looking to expand the menu, and this would be one of those items. But notice to title for something like this is certainly a more pronounced way to go.
Okay.
And then I'll just add that we're also trying to, as we roll out these new menu features for parcel search, we're trying to get people aware of that. And I think what we've been talking about doing, we haven't yet done, is look at our real estate community to work with them on something like
that's
this.
That's exactly what I was going to say, is maybe that next step or that next stakeholder add is somebody from that represents the National Association of Realtors, because in my mind, there should be a Form 17 version of this for raw land versus SFR.
Right. So we've talked about what that roadshow would look like.
Thanks.
Excellent. Where did I leave off? There we go. Class 3. Okay, so Class 3 forest practices, and then again into the Class 4 general permits as well. The other thing that we're doing that we'll get into in a little more detail is that when there is a residential development, there is very often the magic number of 5,000 board feet, which is the trigger for needing that class, essentially a class two forest practices, or in reality, a class four general permit, which would be a conversion logging. You take the trees off of a residential property, you're going to build on the property, even if it's a 3-acre property, it's still going to trigger that that 5,000 board feet limit. And the 5,000 board feet limit then is in DNR's jurisdiction, with a caveat that it would be a property that was over 2 acres in size. That's DNR's additional label, if you will, that's placed on there. So there are a lot of 2.5-acre parcels in Kitsap County, and they are undeveloped. And there was a problem trying to sell a landowner the idea that they're going to have to pay $1,500 to convert their property through a conversion logging permit that we would process, when it might be just trees right around the house. So the way that we had developed that was that we created what's called a danger tree permit, so that then we worked with the state in creating this danger tree permit, and that we were able to process those. As long as we notified them, they were aware, and then also revenue was notified. The state revenue also charges a 5% excise tax that's placed on the that goes with the loads that are going to market. So those particular loads, then the load tickets are then provided back. The 5% thing, essentially most of the 5% excise that's placed on those logged parcels does come back to Kitsap County directly. So from revenue back to the county, and it's actually funds a school building fund. So school, grade schools and middle schools, high schools, whatever, are provided that money directly, which is quite a benefit. So class one forest practices, again, there's no notification. They're typically logging that's less than the 5,000 board feet. There's no, if someone's going to cut firewood for personal use or something like that, it would fit that category. It's just fairly simple. It's also for larger kinds of logging applicants as well. If they're going to be replacing culverts or existing culverts, as long as they're not creating bridges, and then as long as the culverts are just basically for drainage systems, and then refreshing gravel roads and things like that, forestry roads, those are also exempt kinds of activities. And also commercial thinning. Yeah.
Excuse me. How many board feet do we think we have there?
That right there is about, I would guess, 1,200, 1,500 maybe. Depends on how long the logs are, and it's kind of hard to tell. Yeah. But it's as a general guide, typically a self-loader can put on about 2,000 to 2,500 board feet onto a self-loader log truck when they come in and out. We have some experts in the audience that can probably provide a little better dart throw, but as I understand it, that's the essential numeric there. Also, commercial thinning. So if you have a thinning of a tree stand that isn't commercially viable yet, that's also an exempt activity. So if you have a large forest landowner that goes in and thins the trees to make them grow better light, out competing each other, that type of thing, then that's also part of the mix for a class one. Class two is pretty standard for any kind of large forest landowner. In the photo here is shown a typical tree stand. This is a steel tract Feller Buncher, and there are rubber tired ones as well. So, but the general, you know, guidance on this type of class two forest practice is that they're typically outside of the urban growth area. They're less than 40 acres in size. There's no noticing that's triggered. There is a notification, but not really what's called an approval by the state. They just notify. And typically, there are no streams or wetlands or things like that that are potential impacts. And I liken it to our conditions on our permits. This would be a logging where there's essentially no conditions. There's a landing, there's logging that occurs, and it's required to be replanted.
Is a good recent example of a class two the Bond and Stottlemyre?
Those were class three logging permits because there are streams,
okay,
and wetlands, and they're over 40 acres in
that
size too.
Five.
So those, but they're outside of the urban growth area. Yeah, but they're just that notch above.
Right, yeah. And mm-hmm. It was cleared, no buffers.
Yeah,
no,
right. And then it's going to be replanted, you know, that type of thing. Yeah,
on
there's some streams there,
yeah,
too. Yeah.
I just meant to the road,
yeah,
and property lines. Gotcha.
Yeah,
yeah, thanks for the clarification. Yeah.
So when sensitive areas crop up, that triggers the class three?
Yes, typically, right, yeah. So even if you had a smaller parcel that was a logging proposal, say even a five-acre piece, it still is within DNR's jurisdiction. It's over 2 acres, and if it has significant wetlands or what we call a resource management zone that's associated with that logging activity in DNR land, that would be typically a class three permit. Yeah, right. A class four can also be a class four special permit in DNR land, just one notch above that, where we have a specific circumstance. Maybe there's an inner gorge or there's a very steep slope or things like that where a geotechnical report has to be provided. That's a class four special permit. And then as Scott was talking about as well, the class four specials are also in the, say, aerial spraying applications for really large landowners.
And those large, stay with DNR.
And those stay with DNR, correct. Yes, right. Yep. Very good. And then the other thing that can be a trigger for class three forest practices is, again, if you, I was talking about culvert replacements. If you had a culvert replacement for fish passage, then it would typically trigger the class three forest practices if you had to replace a bridge through that interaction that each logging permit can potentially have with state fish and wildlife and also with the tribes. So there are tribal consultations and consultations with fish and wildlife on every timber harvest permit if there's waters of the state involved. And so that is a consultation that we have as well with our conversion option harvest permits, whether they're a class two, three, or the class four general permits. All of those kinds of permits trigger a requirement, and we have a on-site consultation where we walk through the entire site and look and make sure all critical areas are dealt with.
So the earlier draft, step forward, because Allison and maybe some others from the tribe had submitted testimony and requested they be included in. Was there just an oversight in the earlier draft that it didn't mention fish and wildlife in the tribes?
Yes, probably, because the thing that they were not aware of is which type of application we were covering as well. So they weren't aware even of the class four. The differential between class four general and specials.
Okay.
Yeah. Gotcha. So there was a region-wide kind of misunderstanding about that.
A lot of people were telling a lot of other people that we were doing class 4 special, and that was just not the case.
Okay.
Yeah. That's a good clarification, Mike. That's excellent. Okay. Let's get on here. So here's the current state. If you look on the left-hand side here of the panel, we've got we approved the land use, SEPA's done, DCD approves that grading permit, and there's an approval letter that we provide for conversion logging. And then the applicant then takes the entire application and the package and the SEPA decision and everything over to the state and pays $1,500, and then they come back to DCD for that final approval. So this is the class 4 general process as it is now. And then over to the right, then you'll see the class 4 general process as we're going to essentially process it. DCD approves the land use, we approve the grading permit, and then we examine the essential logging application, if you will, because we'll still use the state system. And then we're in the jurisdiction, it doesn't go to the state. So we do it efficiently with the site development activity permit, and it's done in-house at the time of the SDAP approval. So that's what's before us in relation to Class 4 general permits. So this is what Scott was talking about here, that where we are today. Of course, meeting with the Kitsap Environmental Coalition, the Citizen Advisory Committees. We met with the Board of County Commissioners and also advised along the way. We asked people to watch the website, too, and make sure that they were aware of what the status was of this particular process. And also then last, that there's a process improvement tied to this activity as well. Generally, we received 39 comments, including comments from state agencies. The Department of Historic Preservation provided comments as well. They were not aware that we notified all of the tribes when we had a logging permit, so that was helpful for them to clarify that that yes, indeed, cultural resources are also a component of the permits that we review too. So we accepted 18 of the comments. Many of the 39 were just duplication.
When you say accepted the comments, meaning that their ideas were valid for consideration and incorporation?
Yes, and the fact that we had several comments that were duplications that basically said the same or a very similar thing. Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, you bet. So the key comment themes, people were concerned about what was being proposed. They didn't understand our particular process, what we were really talking about for process improvement. They also wanted greater awareness, so many of the people wanted to know, hey, how am I going to know if something's going to be logged next to me? But typically that's with a DNR logging permit, and it was almost always that situation when we drilled down and talked to them. They said, oh, well, yeah, that was that logging on, you know, Gamble Road or up at Stottlemyre or whatever. So also then they wanted to ensure tribal resources were not impacted. So tribal resources, whether they're cultural resource issues or cultural trees or whatever, but that is indeed part of our process, is inviting the tribal folks out to the site to do the site visit with us, directly with us. Fourth, they'd like forestry science to be considered. One of the things that we talked about in our process improvement is the fact that most of the trees grown in Kitsap County are pretty efficiently grown, but it's really more so like a, well, I mean, I hate to say it's like a crop, but it essentially, when you plant Douglas fir seedlings and let them go and they have that full sunlight and grow up as a unit, then they're also logged about the same time as well. So the idea for a little bit different kind of system that we've been working on with Kitsap Parks Department and large county landowners is to try to see if there's a way to provide a little bit of diversity. So in instance, you would replant a Douglas fir stand, and maybe you would do a smaller harvest and let something that's going to continue to grow out to harvest level in, say, a Douglas fir stand, and then the area where you do a logging, you do 100% logging in a county type of permit, but you replant with western red cedar and hemlock and that type of thing that can grow in a shaded condition so that you have a little more diversity brought back in with the forest stand. So it's some of the things we're looking at and try to encourage people to think more of in a diverse way about reforestation. So that's some of the things that we brought forth. We're certainly not forcing anyone, you know, to do logging that way, but in our essential conversion option harvest plans, we'll provide some discussion points, if you will, about some of those ideas and merits.
It's very creative, especially if you can find any way to incentivize it.
Yes.
Right, rather than regulate.
Yes, yeah. Correct. Yeah. So, for instance, someone that wants to do a more extensive logging may be able to replant in a more diverse stand, and so we can look at that and see. We might still require perimeter buffers and things like that, but that we would, you know, be able to allow more intensive logging or things like that. Yeah. The code changes, references to the Washington Administrative Code to inform on state codes. Some of our Title 18.16 references were references that have been changed several years ago. And so it's a refresh on making sure that the codes meet what a definition of a COHP is, conversion option harvest plan, for instance. Then the code applies to forest accesses as well. The use definitions from the state code are the same. And then the clarifying the tribal and agency review and the field visits, those are all things we've added into the body of the revision itself. And then last, clarifies cultural resource notification according to Washington Administrative Code. We've added that as well. And let's see. Title 21, we have a notification procedure. Typically, it's an 800-foot radius. This would be probably for conversion option harvest plans that would be proposed where a SEPA decision would be required. So if we have water on a property or a stream or that type of resource, then we would typically process a SEPA decision with that particular application. So that's kind of still in the mix a little bit, though. You want to speak to that?
Let me add a little bit about that. When you go through the code, you'll see that there's a couple large sections that have been struck out, and they were really procedural in nature. And if you look at our development code, if you look at Title 21, our administrative code, you'll see that it refers to itself, Title 21, as the administrative engine for all of our development code. And so what we've had over the years is different titles having their own processes on how to move things along. And so this was an opportunity to take that out and refer to Title 21. Now, what that created was a lot of concern by people who looked at that and saw that all these processes that were designed to keep the public informed and keep the process transparent was being taken out of code, and therefore we were losing our transparency altogether. And so we really had to kind of educate people that this was not that. It was really trying to further consolidate all of our administrative processes into one area, which includes an 800-foot notification that the board landed on many years ago as the appropriate notification radius for both our urban and rural areas. So that was something that really caught a lot of people's attention.
Okay, excellent, thanks. Okay, and then a little further, where we're talking about the hearing examiner moratorium role. There is a procedure for forest practices for facilities. Say a piece of property was logged under DNR procedure, that there is mechanisms to remove that moratorium, but there's very strict applications to that, and the old code had referenced that the county commissioners had that authority. And so through Title 21, we had rolled that back into the hearing examiner should be able to hear those kinds of applications. Further, the code compliance language found in Title 21 was also rolled into how we're dealing with these kinds of applications. That comes up occasionally where someone logs a property without county or state DNR permits. And so we want to be able to continue to roll code compliance in and go through that code compliance procedure to get someone into compliance if they log a piece of property. You want to speak to that a little?
Let me add just a little bit on that. Since code compliance is something that people start to screw their eyeballs about a little bit sometimes, what Title 21 says is if there's a code compliance case and there's been factually determined that there's an issue with a landowner and resolution is not occurring, and then they come in for, say, an SDAP or a building permit, we have the authority to hold off on issuing that until that prior code compliance issue has been resolved. And so there's really got to be a nexus between what's occurring on site and how the subsequent permit would influence that. So it's a way to bring people back to the table because they really need that next permit, And so it's pretty effective, narrow.
When you say findings, as I read it, it said if there's an open case, or you basically said the same thing?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
And staff is then often rolled into the co-compliance, not so much the investigation, but the role of staff to be able to rectify whatever that situation is. So we're often rolled into that procedure. Let's see. So, and then finally here, Title 21 requires noticing for all Class 4 general permits. The essential noticing that we're talking about doing is that we're talking about having a specific kind of notification on the website, just like Gov Delivery, where people are notified if they want to come to a planning commission meeting. There'll be a notification process for something in relation to our Class 4 general permits that we're processing, so people are aware that a logging activity in relation to a site development permit and all of the land use activities, that people are just aware, will be made aware that that particular logging is going on. We've had a lot of conversion logging permits this year already. I think probably, 8 or 9 that I can think of now. Aside from any kind of residential-related logging, there's hundreds of them. But one of the interesting things is that the conversion option harvest plans, we really don't process very many of them because most landowners are thinking in more of a long term if they have a property that that they've been growing trees for, you know, 38 years or 45 years or what have you, and it's getting ready to harvest, they're going to harvest, and they're going to go through the state anyway. So, and they will continue to have the ability to do that. We have really no jurisdiction over over any DNR logging permit, and never really have, other than that we record that moratorium. Other programmatic issues, the process review. We're going to also have more presence on the ground at the time of the logging activity itself. So we're going to make sure that we have an inspector go out and verify the clearing limits, and that everything is all set and ready to go. We have a lot of development activities where there's required tree retention for buffer purposes and things like that. So we want to make sure that that's dealt with on the ground. And so we have three principal development engineering inspectors that we're in the process of doing training for these. And the beauty of having nine conversion, rather significant conversion logging permits this year so far, is that we have been able to train them up as well. That's been pretty good. And then aside from the fact that this is going to improve the permit process as well for developers, I think that's just an added bonus to this process. And then also this notification procedure too. We hope that people will understand that that if there's a notification, they choose to sign up for a notification, and they see logging activity, they're going to understand that then that's likely going to be a state permit and not a county permit, because the state still doesn't have a requirement to do any kind of notifications whatsoever when there's a state DNR permit. And so we can't do anything about that. But we can do something about our process so that people are aware.
I have a question on that. Just very thing. Now, supposing, you know, as you went up there before and after and during the clearing, and you determined that the guidelines that were set or the boundaries that were set are been violated, what is the consequence for, and how do you do that, deal with that?
Well, again, if someone's in, it's a really good question. If someone's in a violation of their permit, what the department has typically done is worked with them to rectify the violation. I know that Pierce County has a process where if somebody has logged a property and as long as it's been replanted, they'll allow an application to go through a review process to reduce or eliminate that moratorium. But it often involves a bond or something like that. So what the county has done, because that does rarely happen, but it does happen, is to create a replanting bond on the property so that then that area needs to be replanted. There's an associated bond with it, so that they're required to do that in order to have the bond returned back to them. So that's one of the procedures that we've done in the past. But it would be, you know, kind of as Scott was talking about, code compliance, you know, for their particular permit. But we're hoping to have more presence on the ground so that that kind of thing doesn't happen.
Is replanting with little seedlings considered to be?
Yes. Well, there's actually research in relation to that as well. If you replant with 2-0 grade, 2-year pulled forestry stock, you know, type of plants and get them planted correctly so that they're not J-rooted, and put a tree that's a 4-year-old potted plant right next door to it, in 5 years they're going to be about the same size of tree. So because that small little tree, as long as it's got the right amount of sunlight and is again planted correctly, they're going to be about the same height when they come up, because that potted plant is, when it's put in a hole, is often root bound, and so it takes time for that to that potted plant to come up. So there's a lot of research into that, and I've planted zillions of trees in my life too, so knowing the difference.
Notice earlier that in the process that was 6 or 7 steps originally, now looks to be the first 3 or 4. That you mentioned that the $1,500 is taken out of that equation. What that money was going to DNR originally, not to the county,
right?
But was making it back to the county and tended to be related to either school operating budgets or. So what I'm seeing is what may look like. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's the difference between state revenue.
Okay.
Revenue provides that nexus back to a school fund.
Okay.
State DNR, Department of Natural Resources, processes the logging permits themselves.
Right.
And they find it to be, it's not a fundraiser for them. It's, again, there aren't that many conversion logging permits that they deal with. Primarily, they're...
Oh, that's right. You said it came out of the excise 5% on board feed on a ticket tag on.
Yep.
Okay, sorry.
Yep, that's right.
I still would ask, seeing extra thoughtful steps that are now required by staff,
right?
Can you tell us a little bit about the thought process behind funding the effort?
Oh, right. Yeah, right.
Where are you getting the money to be out on site 2 extra times, once with the tribe, once pre-clearing?
Yeah. Well, the conversion option harvest permits that are potentially of class 3 or sometimes a class 4 general permit as well, those particular permits, there is an application fee that's provided to the county to process those. Again, there's not very many of them, but we do probably a dozen or so a year. The conversion logging permits, keep in mind, already have a site development activity permit associated with them.
Right.
So the site development activity permit fee,
which is
going to pay for the inspectors to go out there. So we're just going to have that additional check and balance that's part of the site development activity permit.
But no early discussions that SDAP costs would rise accordingly, or it'll come out in the wash and you'll know in a year or two.
I would assume they'll go up a little bit, but again, we already have in that particular permit a clearing limit, site visit and things like that. Yeah. So if you want to talk to that.
It's our hope that we can realize some efficiencies so that it doesn't go up. But I also wanted to point out that we have a lot of unauthorized activity. I think if you move from south to north, you'll find that in north end, it's probably the bulk of the complaints to the commissioners. Now, the idea is, and I think you've heard this model discussed before, the idea is that with our inspectors, that those guys can be sort of soft code compliance officers, so that if they are driving by on the way to inspect somebody's house and they see somebody doing some clearing, they can say, hey, they can stop by and say, hey, did you know that we've got a permit for what you want to do? It's not that much money. What you're looking at here is relatively inexpensive. Permit, we'd like you to go ahead and head back to DCD and get a permit for that if you can. So we're hoping that that kind of on-the-ground presence will help as well.
And that is what we hear a lot of complaints on, even in the rural area from neighbors, is, gee whiz, my neighbor had a perfectly safe stand of trees or whatever, and it's like, but they're building a house right in the middle of it, and so they're taking that inner core of the protected tree zone out of the mix. And we actually want to make sure that those people are safe. So we don't want a, you know, a 3-foot diameter Douglas fir to crash through the middle of their house. So if there's a risk, we want that risk to be reduced. And so we'll review those forested properties, typically with their residential permit, where we're going in and making sure that, you know, that we understand that their tree removal is going to be subject to county conversion review, if you will, which we're going to go through this process. And then as well, that state revenue is also in the mix, so that we make sure that revenue is also incorporated, so that we're not losing revenue money that's, you know, 2 or 3 log truck loads that are going off of a property and not then providing that additional funding for the building fund, you know. Okay. Yeah. Let's see. Next step. So here we are now. We have reviewed the comments and code. We're hopeful to set the additional date for our public hearing. That's our hope tonight. And looking for any other Planning Commission guidance that you may have. I think that's it, isn't it? Yeah, I think so. Oh, here. Our contact info. And I think
that's it. So we're, you know, we're at a point where if the Planning Commission at the end of this work study on this element is ready, we may not have a date in mind, but just authorizing us to ready for public hearing I think would be good for us. I think we still got a little bit of work to do to make sure that the public hearing is robust and people are well informed and we've reviewed their comments finally for this group. But also, if you have questions about code, we're prepared to go through code tonight and do a walkthrough on that. So it's really at your discretion if you want to, if you have any questions about code or if you want more of a deeper dive, we are ready to go in any direction you want.
Are you making reference to getting deeper into code under this existing work study, not item
yes.
F on the agenda?
That's
okay.
Correct.
Okay. In the interest of starting discussion, do I have a motion to approve the request that DCD can go to public hearing with what was studied this evening?
So moved.
We have a first. Do we have a second?
Second.
Mr. Svensson, second. Great. Open for discussion. Any comments?
Basically, we're saying, yeah, we'll go ahead and go to public hearing, but we haven't set a hard, fast date of when we want to do this.
Right, right. What I don't want to do is lock down a date. I mean, we could lock down a date and then just continue it, but we've got some people that I think we'd like to meet with a little bit more. One of the variables that I don't have any control over is when we make a suggested change to the code for the public hearing, I've got to run it by DNR and ask if they or their legal department has any concerns about that. And for the draft in front of you today, I asked that comment a couple months ago from DNR. I still have not heard back from them. So now that's a matter of just yanking some chains, I think, to try and get that moving along a little quicker. But that's one of the variables I don't have any.
Would it be reasonable to request that at another meeting, especially since we barely make quorum tonight, that you do, knowing we have another work study in front of us, that you do come back, hopefully after having heard from DNR and any other stakeholders who you are waiting for advice from, and that we do review the code portion of what you were ready for this evening?
Sure.
But then you would have already had other checked boxes from other departments along the way. I think it'd be nice for us to hear the code piece of it before you're at hearing examiner.
I agree.
Okay.
Okay. So.
It sounds like we're still, you still have some issues that you're working through on the code.
I would say that based on what I know today, there are two minor issues left to work on with code, based on some comments we've had. There could be more as people look at this again and again. Right. And also, DNR still hasn't gotten back to us about the current draft. What I sent to DNR some time ago was the draft that the public commented on, and they were okay with that. But then we received those 18 comments, and we made changes. And I sent that to DNR and said, hey, we think these are okay. What do you think? And they've not responded yet. So this would certainly give us a little more time to maybe talk to somebody's boss, perhaps, if that's what it takes, and get buy-off on those.
Would someone like to move on how that original motion is amended so that we might vote on that?
Or if you have a suggestion, the maker of the motion and second can consent to it.
It could be open to, go ahead.
I would make a suggestion here that if we could see a schedule of where you think this is going to work out, you know, kind of lay it out as, sorry, we're going to have another work study. We're proposing a public hearing within weeks of that.
Okay.
You know, and stuff. And then have it so that it's kind of laid out on our schedule of, all right, we have these things to go. It's kind of like our Growth Management Act proposals that we have. We've got a nice schedule laid out of, here's the proposed. It's not set in stone, but it does kind of give us a heads up of
let's move forward
on that.
It's just critical path, right?
Right.
That's blocked out. That we'll know what's coming up, and that yes, we did in fact get what we asked for, that X is gonna come before Y is gonna come before Z.
And it would also give anybody that's reading the minutes and all that a heads up of, oh, this is coming up. Let's, you know, we're not surprised. Next week we're going to do a public hearing.
And I don't think it's a bad practice in general with public disclosure for them to see if, oh, I wanted to go hear that, but I'm out of town for 6 weeks or, you know.
Sure. Okay.
Is there any disadvantage to not having the motion adopted tonight and waiting until the July 16th meeting, or is it advantageous for you to get direction from the commission tonight?
I don't know that I need any formal direction from you. I think I've heard what you want pretty loud and clear, so there's no formal direction that's needed for that. I would suggest that July 16th is probably a little too close, so maybe first meeting in August we can come back to you. And at that time, we'll be prepared to go over code and any of the changes that we've been touching on as well with our workholder group. And then we'll come to you with a schedule for hearing and adoption. And at that point, I'm very hopeful that we'll have DNR on board with the code changes. And we'll talk a little bit more about what the transfer of jurisdiction and the 60-day kickoff for that looks like as well.
Yeah. Now, just on, we don't have our lawyer, Shelley's gone, but if you don't get a comment back from DNR, it sounds like DNR's kind of gone, hey, we proposed it, they sent it, we approved it, we're done. And it's kind of like they're kind of, well, this is just noise. And
well, so we're fortunate that our attorneys generally look out for our interests, both in terms of what's, you know, considered statewide and local ordinances and court cases and so on. So they'll look out for our best interests. It's just that DNR has a very specific checklist that they roll through for these transfer of jurisdictions. And we've got to make sure that they're checking their boxes, because before this is finally turned over to Kitsap County, the DNR commissioner and the revenue commissioner and I think ecology also is looking at this. So. It's really kind of us making them check their boxes, and I think we can do that.
So they will get back to us.
They,
okay.
They will.
In the interest of the fact that I made a motion, then there was a second for discussion, it sounds like we should, in theory, vote to deny or postpone the idea that you're going to hearing examiner, but that there's work to do and it's still the right direction. Sorry, public hearing.
Yep.
Excuse my languaging. Yeah. So I guess since there was a motion on the table about giving them the go-ahead to go to public hearing, all those in favor? All those opposed?
Okay. A secondary way to do it would be to have an agreement between the motion maker and the seconder to withdraw the motion.
Then it could be withdrawn. Okay, so I will not count that vote. I will make the motion that we withdraw what was on the table, knowing that the timeline discussed actually makes more sense. Jim, are you willing to withdraw the second?
I will withdraw my second.
Very good. It's off the table.
Maybe, I agree. And maybe just for the meeting minutes, just say there was general consensus or agreement among us with the comments and concerns you guys expressed and the staff's suggestions.
Right.
So
yeah.
I have direction without a formal
motion. Exactly. The direction is still the same. It's just that let's buy the time needed and get the additional information and get back to us.
Okay.
All right.
All right.
Good. Is that the end of anybody's thought process or commentary on item E, the work study? Or do you guys need closing?
No, I think we're good.
I think the only thing we may add in relation to some of the things that we're still working out is really in relation to the conversion option harvest plans. I think that what we've seen thus far is everyone was in agreement on the class 4 general conversion logging permits. I think that we're pretty sure that everyone's very comfortable with that particular procedure and the way we've developed that. But it's been some clarifying language in relation to conversion option harvest plans that that we've had with some of the timber owners for clarifying purposes. Some of the ideas would be, buffer requirements for perimeter buffers, just to have some clarifying language on if there's a residential development behind that. Does it make sense to have a bunch of leave trees in a 25-foot buffer? Well, no, not really. So some of the things that we're working on are things like this. So, and then obviously when you do a logging, you need a landing site for those logs to be stacked. And often that area is rather significant, but we do have some code sightings in relation to the actual DNR sightings, if you will, for landing best management practices, where DNR requires those landings to be tidied up and erosion control practices be implemented. So I think that we have a nexus, but we haven't had that secondary meeting yet with these folks. So we have that application process in the COHPs that we're hoping to clarify for them as well.
Yeah, that's a preview of the code tweaks we're looking at.
Okay. Very good.
And once again, thanks for the comment matrix. You guys do a fantastic job. I know you've heard me say it before, but it's extremely helpful. I try as much as I can to read all the written testimony, but it's nice to be able to go back, have that reference, particularly when you agree to modify any of the drafts, and then you highlight those. It's very helpful.
Oh, thanks. And I'll just say, if you can see any other improvements that we can do, we're happy to consider those and use those.
And there's our emails up there. Should you want any kind of clarifying anything, please feel free.
As a general note, and Robin, if you could note this, usually if you convert your files to PDFs, it does not cause headaches on our end. When I get a Word document, all hell breaks loose.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It's like, oh, you're not licensed to watch this. And, you know, it's like, come on.
Okay.
So,
We've had that internal.
I get where you're going. So,
PDFs are great.
Okay.
With regard to item letter F, Peter, do you mind if we take a 5-minute recess just to let those leave that want to leave? And
right.
Okay, if we could, it is 6:59 and 35 seconds. We'll take 5 minutes.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.